Hello, and welcome to the Olympic and Bundy podcast. I'm Kelly Taylor. Today on the show is Norman Alajum. He's a successful Hollywood talent manager, producer. He previously worked as an attorney, and most recently, he wrote a book. The book is very special because it's made up of letters that he wrote to his daughter, Mackenzie, called From Me to You, Stories About Life, Love, Family, Faith, and How to Negotiate a Bigger Allowance. Mackenzie was born when Norman was 45, and being an older parent, he wanted to make sure she knew how he felt about this and that. So over the course of a year, Norman sat down and wrote about various topics in his life, stories, and lessons he wanted to make sure to pass on. Everything from the birds and the bees to life and death, religion, marriage, failure, success, the time he almost died in Morocco. The idea of it, writing letters to your children for them to have and read throughout the years of their life and to be able to pass this on to their children, is really a beautiful gift. One that probably becomes even more appreciated and loved with age. And while the letters were written for Mackenzie, the book is funny and relatable for anyone. Norman is a gem, and I really enjoyed the chance to talk to him. So I hope you enjoy.
From the Fox 11 studios in Los Angeles, California, it's the Olympic and Bundy podcast with host Kelly Taylor.
Oh, I saw that you just had, we're at a premiere for a movie you produced, Simple Wedding.
Yeah, I produced a movie, Simple Wedding, that just had its world premiere at the LA Film Festival.
How was that?
Fantastic.
Is that pretty thrilling when you finally get to go to a premiere and see everyone watch it and react to it?
Yeah, it's not my first, it's not the first film I've done, but it's always, you know, when you work so hard on something and then just, and it was a lower budget film. It wasn't a $50 million studio movie.
Yeah.
So when you know how hard you worked and you did everything from producing to, you know, carry the water to the gaffers.
Yeah.
And then everybody comes together. It was very well received. It was really, really fun and fulfilling.
Gotcha. So I assume maybe you've worked on movies of every different budget.
I have, yeah, movies and TV shows, you know, high and low.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you like working on smaller films like this because it's more, is it like, you know, smaller team, more camaraderie, or is there a difference?
I don't find a difference. I think it depends on the people in the project less than the budgets of the project.
Gotcha.
Sometimes when you go through the wars of a lower budget film, and then you have wonderful war stories to tell.
Oh yeah.
But you know, it's all the same. A $50 million film, you're still fighting. You're just fighting at a, you know.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
a bigger
yeah.
trailer. It's a four more shoot days, but it's the same fight. You know.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, but it was fun. It was fun.
I can't imagine, but I know what you're saying. In a way.
Well, come produce one with me.
Yeah, I mean, shoot. Are you working on anything right now?
We're working on a few. We have a few movies in development, and we have one that was going to go this fall. We had Sharon Stone attached to start, and then she had some health issues and fell out. So we're kind of back to the drawing board. My guess is we'll go first quarter of next year now.
Gotcha. That's a grind.
Yeah, look, as my grandmother would have said, it beats working in the coal mines, right? So.
Did she say that?
She really did. Oh. She really did. Yeah, she was an immigrant, you know.
That's one detail. There's certain parts. There's so many things that I loved about the book that you put together and wrote and have given to the world. But specifically, I love all the details about like your parents, your grandparents,
yes.
that your daughters can read and like just have in your family. You know, it's just like written in stone. That was one thing that really stood out to me. But
thank you.
So before we talk about the book, you were born in Montevideo?
I was born in Montevideo in Uruguay, yes.
And is that the capital?
It is. And then we moved to the U.S. just before my eighth birthday, right around my eighth birthday.
Do you have a lot of memories of like first getting to, so you moved to Cleveland, right?
Yes.
Do you have a lot of memories at that age of what it was like?
I have one or two vague memories, you know, just enough.
Yeah.
Just enough. I actually have a vivid memory, and I think I write about it in the book, of being at the airport. You know, this is 50 years ago, right? Being at the airport, it felt very much like Casablanca. We're all outside. There's a little propeller plane. You know, I actually have a very vivid memory of that, weirdly enough.
Yeah. Did the whole family come? Like, did your grandparents come as well, or was it just your immediate family?
Immediate family came, and then my grandparents followed a couple of years after that.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. So then you're in Cleveland, and then we were talking about on the way up, then you moved to Georgia briefly.
Yes.
And back to Cleveland.
Yes.
Did you like Georgia?
I loved Georgia. I had a nice time there, and I have nice memories from there. One of the chapters is about, you know, a young woman I had a crush on there, yes, in sixth or seventh grade, whatever that was.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, no, we had a nice time in Georgia. I had a funny situation. I remember going to the Masters golf tournament. I was 11 years old, 12 years old, in Augusta, and Jack Nicklaus, who at the time was the premier golfer of his day, was sort of playing through, and somehow I got, you know, off of the wherever the fans were, and I went up to him and said, "Oh, Mr. Nicklaus, may I have your autograph?" And he sort of like went right by me, didn't even look at me. And so for years, I hated Jack Nicklaus. And then, of course, when I was an adult, I realized, oh, my God, the guy was playing in a major tournament, this knucklehead kid, you know? So I owe Jack Nicklaus an apology from my Georgia days.
It's funny. Do you ever wonder, like, how if you had that effect on someone? Like, you just were doing something, and then maybe you. I'm like,
well, I'll tell you, that has happened to me in business, because I've run a number of companies in the entertainment world, and people will come up to me that, and I don't even know who they are, or I don't remember who they are, and they say, "Oh, Norm, I used to work for you at your company, and you were always so good to me." And so I always think to myself, thank God I was good to them. There's a lesson in there somewhere. You know?
100%. Yeah. I mean, you can only really recognize, like, you might actually talk about this in your book, like 150 to 200 people.
Yes.
Before it gets like, I can't keep stored in my brain. There's not enough room.
Yes. Yeah. And you know, when you get, you know, into your 40s and beyond, it's like there's just too much going on. You can't remember everyone and everything, you know?
Oh, definitely. So you went to law school,
yes,
became an attorney. Where'd you go?
UCLA.
What made you move to California?
When I was a junior in college, it's a funny thing because as an immigrant to this country, my family was all about assimilation. We were not at all about movies, television. You know, I like to say that by the time I was 18 and went to college, I maybe had seen 3 movies in my whole life. And 1 or 2 television shows. That was just not in my consciousness. It was nothing I knew, wanted, understood. And then when I was a senior in junior in college, because I played baseball in college. Yeah. And so during the season, if you're a college athlete, they tell you to take, quote unquote, the easier courses because you're traveling with the team and whatever else. And someone had told me in my junior year, there's a class called Introduction to Film, where all you do is watch movies and then you write a term paper at the end. And I said, well, shoot, I can do that.
Yeah.
And I took the class. It was taught by a guy named Louis Gianetti, who really changed my life. And I fell in love with film, and I fell in love with show business and entertainment and telling stories and content. And
gotcha.
As an immigrant kid, the good way to get out to LA was to go to law school. So here I came. Here I came.
So how long did you work as an attorney for?
I would say almost 7 years.
What kind of cases did you take on?
I was an entertainment lawyer. I don't know my way around a courtroom.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, other than if I'm fighting parking tickets or something.
Oh, I need that.
But no, I was an entertainment lawyer doing transactional.
Gotcha. Okay, so you touch on this a little bit, just knowing and appreciating the power of film, like various forms of art. So
yes.
I'm assuming that was probably just your way of kind of getting into it a little bit.
That was. And my father was, I think I may have talked about that in the book, my father was a well-known orchestra conductor in his youth in Europe and then in South America. So we grew up with the arts. I grew up with symphony and opera and art. And that was all a part of our upbringing, although weirdly not movies or television.
Gotcha. Yeah. There's 2 people that you dedicate the book to.
Yes.
In the beginning. And I quote, "For my sister Vivian, who always told me I had a gift for writing, and for my 11th grade English teacher, who always told me I didn't."
Yes.
Which, that stings. Did you, just kind of thinking back to this time in your life, were you, with the exception of this English teacher in 11th grade, did you like writing? Was writing an easy way for you to express yourself, or was this sort of something that came upon later?
I think I came upon it in college is when I started really loving to read and loving to write. I was an English major in college. I think that's when it kind of hit me.
That
this is a fantastic way to express yourself, to give birth to your emotions and your feelings and what you want to say to people.
Yeah.
College, I think, is what woke me up to it.
Gotcha. Okay, so you're working as an attorney for several years, and then at some point you make the transition to become a talent agent and start producing movies and shows and talent manager, start your own company. Was going from being an attorney to this other part of your career, a hard transition?
It was a very easy transition that got hard, that got harder as we went. I actually left the law business to produce a movie that I had co-written. This is, you know, many years ago. And I just got it made so easily and fluidly. And I was like, my God, this is so easy. I'll go do that. And then you realize, you know, it's like winning the Super Bowl as a rookie. And then you're saying, oh, it's so easy to get to the Super Bowl. And then, then it's hard. Good luck getting back.
So this is my life.
Yeah, exactly.
It's easy.
Exactly.
Gotcha. Okay, so I've heard you talk a little bit about that you started writing letters, fast-forwarding a little bit. You started writing letters and posting them online as part of a blog or on Facebook.
Yes.
Was there a particular topic that sparked this? Or a moment that sparked this?
There was a moment that sparked it. I don't know if there was a topic, but the moment is by the time Mackenzie was born, who's our youngest daughter, I was already a little bit of an older dad. And there was so much that I wanted to tell her and share with her about our life, about what her life might be, about what my hopes and dreams were for her. But, you know, when you're a kid and you're 10, 11 years old, you don't have a capacity for it. You have no interest in it. Your parents are getting annoying. You don't want to hear any of that. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, maybe I should just write some letters to her telling her how I feel, just so it's there, if God forbid something were to happen. And so I decided I was going to write her a letter a week for a year. And I wrote the first letter, and it came very easily to me. And I said, oh, this is fantastic. And then week two, I sat down to write, and I said, oh, my gosh, I don't know what to write. I'm done.
Yeah.
And so really to hold myself accountable, I posted the letter on my Facebook page. And I just said, I'll be writing one of these every week for a year. Look for it here. Because I thought, I'll be embarrassed if I then don't do it.
Right.
And then I just made myself do it. And, what came out was beyond fulfilling and amazing.
Yeah. What was the reaction of your Facebook friends?
Well, humbly, everybody loved the stories. One of the things that was really interesting about the stories, because you've read the book, you know, they're very specific stories. I don't say, oh, young girls should do this or young boys should do that. They were very specific stories about Mackenzie and me and our family and her grandparents and whatever it is. But what I found was my Facebook friends, and then I started as a blog, literally, which was widely read, amazingly widely read. And everyone was saying, these stories are so universal. I really got something out of this. And that's where I went. One of the most amazing things that happened, and I realized because I represent artists in my career, right? And you see what the power that art can have. About 3 or 4 months into writing it, I got a call from a friend of mine. He was sort of a Facebook friend to your question, right? He wasn't a dear friend or anything.
Right.
I didn't see him that often, but I knew him a little bit. And he called me up one day and he said, you know, I just want to tell you, I love your blog. And by the way, your blog has saved my life. And I said, oh, thank you. That's so nice of you, whatever. And he said, no, you're not hearing me. Your blog has saved my life. And I said, what are you talking about? It's a blog. How could it save your life? He said, look, you don't know this about me because we're not that close. We're more social media friends. But over the last couple of years, I've had some very big reversals in my business life, in my personal life. I've had a death in the family, this and that. And truly, over the last few months, I've woken up some days and said, my God, I should just end it all and be done with this. And because I was posting once a week. He said, and whenever I would get that, it was almost like if that day you would post a letter and I would read the letter and see your love for your family and think about my family and my mom and my whatever. And it gave me the will to go forward and live. I was like, wow.
I imagine that probably helped you keep this going,
yes,
too.
Yes, 100%.
Hearing that and being like, wow.
100%.
This is actually impacting more than just...
Well, the notion is, because people also say to me, when did you set out to become an author? And I say, I didn't set out to become an author. I set out to write letters to my daughter. But what I realized as it became a blog and as people started responding to it and with, you know, that kind of a story that I just told you, it just made me want to continue.
Yeah. Wow. That's like a really powerful thing for someone to share with you. And
Kelly,
tell you.
I know.
And to your point about it being kind of specific toward Mackenzie, mm-hmm. It definitely, there's so many things that you can relate to, like touching on failure, failing, and like how that, you have to like embrace that to get to points that are highs in your life. There's so many different things. And I wrote down, actually, this part sort of made me tear up in the very beginning. You're talking about how you thought of having Mackenzie about a month after you turned 45.
Yes, yes.
You talked about your life expectancy in
Mackenzie years. Yes.
Sort of meaning like when she's 45, you'll be 90. And like just thinking about where you'll be in your life when she is at certain points in her life. And I feel like everyone does that. You know, I think about that in reverse with my own parents.
Yes.
You know, which is really touching.
And as a parent, you really, and the reason I think about Mackenzie years is you want to see how it all turns out. Mm-hmm. You want to make sure they're okay. You want to make sure that you have given them certain fundamental values. You want to make sure that they're happy. You want, I'm the father of three daughters. I want to make sure they're empowered. I want to make sure that they understand who they are and who they can be in the world. That's, you know, the fulfilling thing about being a parent, in addition to them thinking you're annoying.
Yeah. You have good jokes, like the part where, which I didn't even know this, I wrote it down, the 14th president of the United States is Franklin
yes.
Pierce. I've never even heard that name. Franklin Pierce.
Well, like,
we skipped that chapter.
A little history for you.
In history. We didn't touch on that. Did you always imagine yourself as a parent?
No.
No?
No. I never had the drive to be a parent. When Laura and I got married and I inherited two children who I adore, and then we had one and my life changed completely.
Yeah.
But I was not driven to be a parent at all.
Gotcha. So some of these lessons that you wrote down to pass on to her, these just probably came up in raising your children, I'm assuming, right? It's not like you were thinking about ways that you would explain certain topics to your hypothetical children, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, they're the lessons of our lives, right? So you talk about the letter I write about the importance of failure, the importance of failure in getting to success, the importance of failure in being a happy human being. We all sort of know that as we reach adulthood. But if you have children, it makes you articulate those lessons. And, it, you know, it's like they say teachers learn. When I had to tell Mackenzie about the importance of failure, it really made me understand what that has been in my life. And because I've always been very entrepreneurial. I've had very high highs, very low lows. Those are the twin engines of an entrepreneurial or an artistic life.
Yeah.
And to write about it really crystallizes it.
Yeah. And that's a topic that I almost feel like the older you get, the better you understand that notion of, you know, how you have to fail to reach certain highs. Like, I almost feel like the more you do it, the more you understand it. So while maybe she would read that particular letter at 18, it might impact her even more, like, years down the
road.
Yes.
My goal of this book with respect to Mackenzie and my other two daughters is, as they get older, the book will have more resonance, not less.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful notion for me to think about.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Yeah, the part about going back to your parents, the little details about your grandfather moved to Uruguay at 50, started his life over, had to learn Spanish, and then at 70 moved to Cleveland and started his life again. I mean, just like kind of reading that and thinking about it, just it's like, wow, that's a lot for one life. And then your mother, I believe, after the kids went to college, earned her bachelor's and master's degree and then got a PhD.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Yeah. I mean, it's just interesting stories that as you get older, I'm sure your children will be like, wow.
The other nice thing about the book is I think forward. For my own family, it's a little bit of family lore. And from a universal perspective, you see what constitutes the journey of a life and an afterlife. I talk about that. I talk about faith. I talk about all those things.
Yeah. So one thing that really struck me, this might be maybe obvious for you, but Mackenzie was born a few hours before September 11th, 2001, before the towers fell.
Yes.
A couple hours before, right?
Sure, an hour. Literally 1 hour.
Literally 1 hour before. There's at the very end of this letter, there's a whole letter talking about the day you were born, and which seemed to be very emotionally up and down. My worst nightmare is going to the hospital too late and missing the epidural.
Yes.
Which
which my wife did.
Yeah.
Yes.
that's always a fear. And sort of there was the umbilical cord was wrapped around her. So there was a point where you were like, everyone was sort of worried about the health of her and your wife. And luckily everything came to be. It was okay. She was brought into the world, this light. Woo. And then of course, September 11th happens. And you write, toward the end of this particular chapter. Even in the context of that tragedy, you reminded us on that day, talking to Mackenzie, as you do every day, that no matter how dark things get, there is always light. You also reminded us that sometimes you have to fight for that light and pray for it and push for it as if your very life depended on it. This, to me, could resonate in so many different aspects of someone's life. And and it's interesting because in hearing this and learning that Mackenzie was born on that day, there's a whole generation that was born post-September 11th. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, even people who don't remember that and could be deployed to Afghanistan. You know, it's interesting. I didn't, and probably anyone with this birthday, that might be kind of hard to reckon.
Well, it's interesting. I've thought about that a lot. Number one, one of the darkest days of our history is one of the happiest days of my life. And so think about the yin and the yang of that. And interestingly enough, I remember the day that she was born, my phone calls went back and forth between, hey, guess what, Dad, we had a daughter and she's healthy and it's Mackenzie and blah, 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 to calling my colleagues in our New York office and saying, are you okay? Mm. Is everyone in your family accounted for? What's going on? What can we do to help? So the downs and the ups, not only of Mackenzie's own birth, but of what was going on in that time is just a crazy, crazy life experience. But I've thought about the notion of Mackenzie as being born on that day. But what I realize, she's now 17. What I realize is she's far enough away from that. It's almost like if someone of my generation is thinking about, oh, I was born on Pearl Harbor Day. Mm-hmm. You understand the historical significance, but there isn't an emotional connection like the one you and I may have felt on that day.
Right. Right. Maybe someone's birthday on September 11th, 1950.
Yeah,
who was alive.
That's exactly right.
Gotcha. The chapter about the birds and the bees, I think, should be a standalone book, like a mini book. Because mm-hmm. that's such a, like, awkward topic. It can be. Or it doesn't have to be. I'm sort of the mentality that if you just talk about things in the open, that doesn't give it as much power. You know, it's not as awkward if you just talk about things. So before we get into it, I wrote down just a little bit, if you wouldn't mind reading from here to there.
The whole thing?
Yeah.
That whole thing?
Yeah.
So this is the birds and the bees. It's just to set the table. It's a father thinking about how he's going to talk to his daughter about the birds and the bees, which is both awkward and, to your point, at least potentially awkward and embarrassing and all those things. And so I try to capture, mm-hmm. I don't know what you're having me.
Oh, so the part that I didn't include is where you basically explain, like, this is actually how bees mate. This is how
yes,
birds
yes,
mate.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah, yes.
Kind of the very scientific bits of it.
Yes. Oh, I see where you're going. Yeah. But I also think, and again, as the father of three daughters, and again, we live in a very peculiar time and what's going on now with the Supreme Court and all those things, it's a crazy time. But I believe with all of my heart that the notion of a woman thinking she's inferior or not up to snuff in any way is wrong, and I don't want my daughters to think about all that, and that includes sex. So mm-hmm. this is what this is. Mackenzie, always be proud of your body and enjoy it to the fullest. The human body is the most amazing instrument in so many ways and can bring great pleasure and joy to both you and your partner. Don't let anyone convince you that sex is bad. Don't let anyone convince you that sex is not for the woman's enjoyment or pleasure. Don't let anyone convince you that sex is shameful or should be hidden from light or is in any way abnormal, no matter what crazy fantasies titillate you. And I can't believe I'm writing this to you. So awkward. So yes, go crazy. Experiment to your heart's content. Have fun. Think about the box. Think outside the box. Be wild in a safe way. Never stop. And whatever you do, Mackenzie, never, never, and I do mean never, share any of that with me. Did I mention to never share that stuff with me? I don't even know how much of that you should share with your mother. But me, nada, niente, nothing, never. You should also know that the life lessons learned from the birds and the bees have twin engines of hope and despair, of euphoria and desperation, of pleasure and pain. And I don't mean S&M. It's not easy for any person, let alone a young person, to completely disconnect his or her hormones from their hearts and from their minds. When one partner is more emotionally attached than the other, and even if both partners are equally attached emotionally, the birds and the bees can cause heartache and tears. There's no getting around it. For all the delicious excitement you will experience, from time to time you will also experience a broken heart, accompanied by a seemingly tragic sense of despair. As much as your mom and I would give anything to shield you from the downside of the birds and the bees phenomenon, we simply can't. Everyone needs to go through it themselves. We can only love and support you unconditionally when you are sad, lend you our shoulders and our ears when you need them, and carry you forward as and when we are able. In those difficult moments, we will tell you, though it will be hard for you to believe at that time, that this too shall pass. From what I know of you so far, Mackenzie, I suspect you'll attack this topic with the same passion and gusto that you've shown for everything else that has come your way in life. That thrills me and scares the living daylights out of me all at once. Your mom and I and your older sisters will be there for you when you need us. But please, be gentle with us. I don't know if your education in the birds and the bees will be overly hard on you, but I can only imagine its toll on us. All my everlasting love, and with a shotgun at the ready, Dad.
Did you get a lot of input from your wife as you were writing some of these letters?
None. No, and you know how I could tell if a letter was working or not? I would write them, and then I would show them to her, and if she laughed or cried or emoted, I knew I was on the right track.
Yeah, definitely. I think that there's so many in here that are funny and like poignant and insightful and just loving, and that was one of them to me because I feel like most of the time you learn about things like that from your friends.
Yes.
You know? It's I don't know a lot of people who had the opportunity to talk about some of this stuff with their parents in a way that they weren't like, oh, this is so awkward or whatever. And I just love how you put it out there, and it's not like, I don't know, she can read it later. Appreciate it.
And one, I would say two interesting things about this particular letter, and I've gotten a lot of fantastic feedback about the book generally, but this letter people seem to love. Interestingly enough, shortly after, no, I'm lying, about 4 or 5 years after I wrote that letter, Mackenzie was probably 16 or 15 at the time, she and my wife and I were out to dinner, and somehow she said something about, if you will, the birds and the bees, and we just got into the conversation. And to your point earlier, it was the most easy, unawkward conversation ever.
Yeah.
So all of the anxiety that went through my head as I envisioned having this conversation in real life did not come to be.
Yeah. I almost wonder if it probably helped too in real life conversations having sat down yourself and really thought about what to say.
I'm sure it did.
You know?
I'm sure it did. Yeah. Yeah.
Did your parents talk to you about that stuff?
No. Oh my gosh.
No.
No, no.
Okay.
No. I think if I started talking to them about it now, they would be like, oh,
they'd be like, stop. Yeah.
No. Different generation, different culture. No.
Gotcha. I'm wondering if there was any topics that you knew you wanted to cover, but you just didn't know how to approach it. And what comes to mind is sort of the topic of sort of the inner conflict between like the meaning of life, religion versus science. There's one chapter where you talk about fasting and Yom Kippur, and then another where you guys went to the Natural History Museum and you're looking at the billions of stars and the billions of galaxies and how, you know, it's unlikely that we're the only intelligent life, and sort of grappling with that. I love how honest and open you are about sort of that inner conflict of what do I believe? Why are we here? Whatever. Because it seems like, at least to me, you think about when you have children that you'll have maybe some definite thing you can tell them about this or that, but probably not a lot of people do, I would think. Was this kind of topic overall, just because it's so complex, hard to approach, like when you sat down to write about this stuff?
This funny you should say that. This particular topic was actually easy for me to approach because, as you know from reading it, I don't have the answers. I still question now. We don't know what's out there in the afterlife or in the universe or whatever. What I wanted to impart, and Mackenzie and anybody else who reads this book, is an openness in thought about how to approach faith, religion, the afterlife, intelligent beings elsewhere.
Yeah.
We don't know. None of us know really what happens after we pass. None of us know all of that. In fact, what I loved personally about my chapter on faith and religion, I talk, and I've always been interested in this. I took a class in college about it. My thought is this. There are so many narratives, the Jewish faith, the Christian faith, the Swedenborgian church, the Hindus, Muslims.
Mormonism.
But, yeah. But the overall precepts are all the same, right, which I talk about. Have a kind heart. Love your neighbor. Take care of your neighbor and your friend. Believe in a higher power. Love learning. Those are the things that all religions teach. That's what I want my daughters and anyone else who reads the book to get away with. At the end of the day, whether she's Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, Muslim, that doesn't matter to me.
Yeah. It's so funny. When I went to the observatory here in Griffith Park for the first time, I left and I learned the most about the Big Bang Theory and just seeing their exhibit about it.
Yeah.
And I left with those same sort of existential questions just from going to something like that. Because you're like, wow. There's a lot out there.
The other thing that you realize and that I've learned from my little daughter, especially when she was 8, 9, 10, 11, is there's a simplicity of thought that is sometimes the right answer. And we as adults overcomplicate everything because either the dogma we've been taught or things we've read or whatever our experiences are. You know, there's that one chapter where I talk about the horses.
Oh.
Yeah, and how she processes the death of one horse and the life of another, and that maybe that's what life is all about. Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. I learned, hopefully I'm teaching her something as she reads it. I learned so much from her in life and in writing the book.
Yeah, seeing the world through her eyes and sort of seeing how she interprets things. I can imagine, definitely. This listening to each letter of this book, it just more and more and more, I couldn't imagine how fulfilling it must have been for you specifically in doing it. Chapter 9, called The Fragility of Life, is a beautiful, beautiful tribute to your mother. Mm-hmm. And 44, The Miracle of Aunt Viv, is the same for your sister. And because I listened to the Audible version, I can almost
hear... Thank you for that, by the way. I love that.
Well, I can almost hear certain moments in your voice to where I'm sure it was maybe hard to record.
Yes.
Just to go over it. And so I'm assuming sitting down and having to go through all this and write it out probably was difficult too. Almost where you'd have to be in a certain mood to sit down and be able to like kind of sift through some of that stuff. Was there a lot of letters in this book that were challenging to do in that way?
I think they were all challenging in their own ways. The two that you make reference to, which is the one about my mom having passed away and my sister, were difficult in different ways, right? My mom had already passed when I wrote it. And so in a way, I was eulogizing her. I was bringing my mom to life for Mackenzie and anyone who might read the book. Probably the most difficult of all the letters I wrote was, if it's 44 or whatever it was, about my sister Viv, because I wrote it as she lay dying. Mm. And so not only was I trying to give my Mackenzie and my family and whoever else a sense of who Viv was as a person, but I was also processing my own grief in real time. And so that particular letter was very hard to approach. It was very hard to write. And in the end, very fulfilling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, because you just have to, I don't know, I just think the thought of sitting down to sort of say, okay, what do I want to say? You end up thinking about all the things that you love and appreciate about them. And just, I'm just sort of in a lot of memories that flow and you just sort of sit in that for a little bit.
What I hoped to capture in those two letters, and you'll tell me if I did or not, was the essence of those two human beings, right? I have 1,000 stories that I could tell. Not all of them fit into a 1,000-word chapter, right? Mm-hmm. But what I tried to capture was, if you read the letter about my sister Viv, to have a sense of who she was, that she was a person of faith, that she loved her family, that she was a human in a community, you know?
Yeah. She comes up a lot.
She does.
So I got the sense that she was sort of like a rock, you know?
Yes.
Like she seems like an aunt. Like I have an aunt that I just particularly have always felt close to, and I sort of felt that about Aunt Viv a little bit.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah. She's that aunt that, you know, she's always there for you, for the kids, for anybody who wants love and reinforcement. But that goes again to the issue of, it's a very specific letter about a very specific human being, but even as you talk to, you know, but it's universal in themes. We all know people like that. We all aspire to be that.
Yeah.
That's what I was trying to capture.
Yeah. And even just learning about her and her husband supported each other.
Yes, yes.
In marriage, you know.
Yes. That,
yeah. What a gal. I'm wondering if you can talk about just your feelings, because Mackenzie started acting from a young age.
Yeah.
She was in Nurse Jackie on Showtime for...
Seven years. Yeah.
And nominated for SAG Award,
yes,
which is awesome.
Yes.
Really cool. And in other shows, she was acting in All My Children?
She was in All My Children for a year and a half. She's done a bunch of movies. It's very funny because she did the Lincoln Lawyer movie where she played Matthew McConaughey's daughter. The happiest 5 or 6 weeks of my wife's life to be on set with Matthew McConaughey.
Can imagine. Yeah. Did the national Broadway tour of Annie.
Yes, correct.
Which is awesome. I'm wondering, because this is the industry that you work in when she's getting into this, and you obviously, if anyone, know certain highs and lows of a career choice like that. And you definitely talk about this in the book, just in the way of, you saw from a young age she was passionate about it, she was good at it, so why would I get in the way of stopping her? But then you're her parent, so you feel like a little bit conflicted because
yes.
You're like, oh, I've seen sometimes where it can be bad, where there can be wolves and demons and other monsters that do step in.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about just your experience in her being a child actor, and is she still? I know that she's a little bit older. I don't know if your thoughts have changed as she's gotten older.
I think her thoughts have changed a little bit. She still wants to act as a career, but now she's a senior in high school. She has found cheerleading and parties and boys. And so, thank God, right?
Yeah.
I mean, she's living that. We wanted her to have that experience, not just being on a set. So I think she has a little bit more balance, but she does say that she wants to go to college, thank goodness. And then after college, she said she wants to go back to acting.
Gotcha. So she did go to... school, not homeschool.
She was homeschooled all the way up through the eighth grade, and then in ninth grade, really coinciding with the end of Nurse Jackie, she went to regular school. And she continued to act, but not quite as much.
Not as much,
yeah.
It's interesting. I feel like I had a great experience in high school and good memories associated with it, like you talk about for you and your wife, and it's almost like you want those things for your kid. Like,
yes.
You want that same experience,
yes.
Even if it doesn't always have to be that way. You sort of want that for your kids.
Look, what I want for my kids and for you and for everybody is to have a wonderful life's journey and a full life. You know, there's a motivational speaker whose name is Les Brown, who I love listening to. And one of the things that he said in one of the speeches that I once heard him say was, most people, when they die, their gravestone could easily say dead, but not used up. My goal for me, for my family, for you, for whoever's listening to this podcast is get used up. Get used up. Win, lose, draw, doesn't matter. Experience life, and that's what I want for her.
Yeah. So she's cheerleading?
She is.
That's
she fun. Is cheerleading, yeah. She's a mini Laura. Yeah, she reminds me of my wife in high school.
Oh, yeah. Was she a cheerleader, your wife?
Yeah. Laura was the it girl, the captain of the cheerleader.
Yeah.
She was that girl in high school, yeah.
I was a cheerleader, but not good.
Ha-ha.
No one got cut. Let's just say that.
That's funny. That's funny.
I'm curious, have you always been good at expressing love? Like, was it ever difficult for you to just, like, say how you feel?
That's an interesting question, and I don't know the answer to it. You'd have to ask those around me. I will say I grew up in an environment, again, culturally and generationally and immigrantly, where that wasn't said. You know, I love my dad, and I know he loves me. I think he said, I love you to me when my daughter was born. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's just not – that wasn't my environment growing up. But I have learned in my life the importance of telling the people you love how much you love them, because nothing is given. And by the way, selfishly, if I love you, it makes me feel good to tell you I love you.
Yeah.
You know, so certainly now in adulthood, I don't have that issue at all. Whether I had it earlier on, who knows? Yeah, who knows?
Gotcha. Yeah, because you're good at it.
Oh, you're so kind. Thank you. Well, I love you.
You are. I think that's how, you know, one thing that I also thought about reading this book is, like, sometimes when I have trouble dealing with someone at work or in life, I think about them as being someone's child.
Oh, that's interesting.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I think about them, for example, you wrote these letters to Mackenzie. If there's someone that I have trouble dealing with at work, I think, like, their parent has so many special memories of them and hopes for them that it makes it a little bit easier sometimes to, if that makes sense.
No, it does. And, you know, what I think about sometimes, look, some people are nicer than others. Some people mesh with us more than others. That's just, that's the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
But what I do something similar, right, than from what you just said. What I do is I think to myself, I wonder what challenges they're going through right now that are making them behave this way. Because I know for myself, for example, when I snap at somebody or this and that, I try not to do it too much. But if I have self-awareness, I know it's because I'm stressed about something or I'm worried about something in my family or whatever it is. So we're humans. We're all trying to do what we can, you know.
Oh, for sure.
But I like the idea, you know, one wonders whether Ted Bundy's mom looked at him and said, oh, I have precious memories.
That's a good point. That's a fair point. Yeah, we shall never know.
Thank goodness. Thank goodness for that.
Is there anything that you went, so you wrote these letters in the year of 2011?
I think it's 2012.
2012.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that you went back and sort of like in the process of putting the book together sort of thought, my opinion of this has evolved or updated in a way?
Boy, that's a good question. In terms of the themes of the book, I would say no. Mm-hmm. I think that has stayed steady. When I went back, when the book got sold and was going to be published and I went back, there were a couple of things that I wanted to update.
Yeah.
As much chronologically as anything. But no, I don't think my views, look, all of our views continue to evolve and hopefully we continue to get wiser and smarter and more seasoned. But by and large, I stand by what I wrote, you know.
One of my favorite stories in the book, which I was like debating printing it out to read it, but I'm not going to do that, obviously, was when you almost died in Morocco.
Oh, yeah.
Just to paint the picture, you're on a, long story short, you're in Morocco, you're on a flight, and there's some stuff going on in the plane. You know that there's some unrest, things that don't normally happen on a normal routine flight, and the pilot comes over the intercom in Arabic,
which
you don't speak.
No.
So you don't know what's happening.
Correct.
And turns out the plane is going down.
Yes.
And
you tell this very well, man.
Yeah,
I'm very intrigued.
I was just scared, honestly, because, and eventually you're here today. So the plane lands and you realize that you don't know what was happening with the plane, but basically it was about to crash. And you don't even know this because you don't speak the language. So everyone's freaking out and then you land okay. Did you ever find out what happened?
I never found out what happened to that plane.
But
one of the things that you say, which is so interesting, and actually it's interesting having you tell me the story makes me think it through a little bit more. Look, anybody being on an airplane, the airplane's going down, people are freaking out. You're going to be scared. You're going to be terrified. You don't want to die. But then add to all of that the notion that because I was in Morocco, it was all happening in a language I did not understand one word of. So I saw people screaming, people weeping, the emergency masks coming down, all that kind of stuff.
Oh, that's a tidbit, I forgot.
Yeah. And you
but
you don't, you know something's dreadfully wrong, but you don't know what.
Mm-hmm.
So that really, you know, accented it even more. But yeah, look, there was, again, to faith, right? There was certainly some higher power at work that day.
Oh,
but I
sure.
I don't know what happened with the plane. I don't know why we didn't crash in the end.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, but that's a crazy, crazy story.
That's insane. I mean, just the feeling of, I get nervous when I hear updates in English. It's just like, people are tense on planes anyways. But.
And also, if you think about pilots, right? No matter what's going on, pilots are known for their sort of calm drawl in any language and over any airspace.
Yeah.
So when they're not calm, when the flight attendants are screaming, when passengers are weeping,
mm-hmm.
crazy.
Definitely. It reminded me of one time I was on a train in Poland and not many people from my experience, I was there in 2012, spoke English compared to in Western Europe.
Yes.
And the train was stuck for hours and no one around me spoke English. And I only speak like conversational Spanish, not well. And turns out a train ahead of our car was on fire.
Oh my gosh.
So we were just sat there forever. But I just, in hearing your story, I was like, wow, imagine that. But it's a plane and in the oxygen mask fall. Okay. So one thing that I wanted to, ask you about was, we sort of talked about it earlier, and you hope that your daughters can continue reading it and appreciate it as they get older and older. Is that sort of the overall impact of doing this book, I would think, is sort of leaving these thoughts and feelings that you have for them out there forever. Mm-hmm. And just, is that sort of the overall impact that you hope the book has?
That, interestingly enough, has evolved. My thinking in that has evolved, to your previous question. Uh-huh. Because when I initially wrote the letters, that was not my thought. It became my thought. My thought at that time was, I want to talk to my daughter, and she's at an age where we can't communicate about this stuff, right? So I just wanted to lay it down. As the letters were written, as time has gone by, as now it's been published as a book and an audible book and all that, my thinking has shifted not only to her, but to her children and her grandchildren. And it's interesting, as a guy who represents actors and writers and directors and understands that they get immortality through their work, this, in a weird way, is my little piece of immortality, of our family story, of who Normal Adjum was in 2012, right?
Yeah.
What was his view of the world? What did he think about faith? Did he love people? Did people hopefully love him? Was he able to say it to, you know, to what you were saying earlier? My thinking about what the book has become and will be has shifted from when I wrote it.
Gotcha.
But I've ended up where you started.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, it's, I mean, even just her, even their, your children being able to find out what was going through his brain when this event in America happened.
Yeah.
You know, even the Chick-fil-A story.
Yes.
Just what did my parents feel about that? You know, it's what did my grandparents think about that when they learn it later? You know, it's
and that's such
cool
an
to have.
Yeah, and that's a, thank you for saying that, because that's such an interesting thought. I don't know about you, but when I think about my parents, and when all of us think about our parents, I think we don't, you know, they are supporting actors in our story. They're not protagonists in their own stories, right? When we're adults and we start thinking about them in that way. So to your point, the notion that when Mackenzie's 50, she can think, oh, this is what my dad thought when I was born. I have no idea what my dad thought when I was born. Do you?
No.
Right?
Yeah.
She will.
Yeah. That's the most beautiful gift I think that you could give someone.
Well, thank you.
I'll tell you this.
The two things that have been most fulfilling, in addition to the obvious of I've written these letters for my family, almost everybody who has read this book or listened to the audible or even read it when it was a blog have said to me one of two things. Either they've said, oh, I wish my dad had written me letters, or they say, I should start writing letters to my kids.
Definitely.
Fulfilling.
Yeah.
Fulfilling.
And if anything, it's just helpful in getting your thoughts out.
Yeah. I recommend it to everybody.
Yeah.
I recommend it to everybody.
Definitely. So if people want to get the book, it's available everywhere. Like wherever you get books.
Bookstores, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Audible. Call me. I'll send you a book.
Yeah. There you go.
I'll sign it for you.
Yeah, and maybe from me to you, the movie coming.
Ah, there you go.
2024.
2024. Yeah. Kelly and I are producing it.
Oh, I'm on it. I'll take on the scene of when you almost died in Morocco.
Oh, perfect. Perfect. You could be the flight attendant running up and down.
Oh, my God. Okay, well, thank you very much for taking the time to come in and share this and talk about your life.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you for having me. What a treat.
Yeah,
what
it's
a
awesome.
Treat. Thank you for reading the book. Thank you for having me.
Okay, that's our show. Thank you for listening to the Olympic and Bundy podcast. Once again, you can get Norman's book From Me to You wherever books are sold, and I highly recommend the audio version that he read himself, which is available on Audible. I also want to say how much we appreciate the people who listen to this podcast and hope you're able to take something away from it, be it a new book to read, maybe an idea you heard someone talk about on the show, or perhaps it just helps you pass the time in the car. So once again, I'm Kelly Taylor, and thank you for listening.